Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC New York Public Radio, this is Soundcheck On Demand. I'm John Schaefer. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open from American Express, presenting the interactive webcast event, Making a Name for Yourself. Kate and Andy Spade and Bobby Brown discuss their leap from business to brand, created by Open from American Express. Registration at openforumonline.com.
To lead a better life, I need my love to be here.
Remember your first job when you were a teenager? You know, working at the corner deli, babysitting, cleaning houses, engineering a Beatles record? This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and my first guest today is Jeff Emerick. He's the four-time Grammy Award-winning recording engineer who got his start in the music business at the age of 15, working with a little-known band of four lads from Liverpool called the Beatles. He worked on some of their best-loved records, including Revolver, Sgt. Pepper, The White Album, and Abbey Road. He's written a book about his experiences at the controls. It's called Here, There, and Everywhere, My Life Recording the Music of the Beatles. And he joins us by phone from his home in L.A. Jeff, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hello there.
So you start your book with the 19-year-old Jeff Emerick tossing and turning the night before you were to sort of get started as the lead, the solo engineer for the Beatles. How much did you know about what you were getting into and who these guys were at that point?
Nothing. No, I first experienced watching them, which was the second day that I was learning the ropes when I joined at EMI Studios, and they were actually there recording a track called How Do You Do It, which eventually became Love, well, not the same song, but anyway, they wanted to Love Me Do to be the first single, and not How Do You Do It by another writer. But there was just a bubbly sort of atmosphere down in that studio, and they just seemed to be having a great time, and they were sort of, you know, young and frivolous and sort of really against the sort of rules that I was sort of told to expect, you know.
Mm-hmm. And you were 15 at the time when you...
Yeah, I was just approaching 16, yeah.
Okay. Now, sketch for us the sort of the organizational flow chart, if you will, in a recording studio. I mean, records are not made just by a band. There's a producer, and then there's the recording engineer. What was the delineation of who did what?
Well, the producer, when I first started, the producer's job was basically to pick the song, the artist, the arranger in those days, because most, you know, artists didn't, they weren't musical people in that sense, although some of them were, of course, in some of the bands, but a lot of the lead people weren't. So his job was really to pick arrangers, artists, songs. So he had really good control over it, and he was really like the director of a film, really, although he's called the producer. So it's like being, you know, directing the film. And the sound mixer, as we were then, was the person that actually mixed all those sounds. It wasn't really a technical job in those days. In fact, we, as youngsters or people in that position, weren't in EMI allowed to touch the something called the patch bay, which would used to route the microphones to different faders on the mixing console. So we just sat there and mixed the tones and the sounds that we were getting from the studio and trying to create sounds down in the studio. So it was more of an artistic slant than a technical slant.
Hmm. So you basically, if the producer is like the director of a film, and the musicians are like the cast of a film, your role then would be akin to the cinematographer.
Well, cinematographer, sure, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the musicians, in this case the Beatles, and the producer, in this case often George Martin, would have these ideas, and then was it up to you to figure out how to actually, to practically make these ideas audible?
Well, it was when I started, as you know, I became there for the recording engineer when we started to record the album Revolver. It was then that, you know, there was demands for new sounds and sounds to be created. Up until that point, you just basically recorded the sounds that were just given to you in the studio, and that was basically it. But it was when we started to do Revolver that the Beatles themselves were fed up with saying, well, yes, it sounds like a piano, but, you know, we don't want it to sound like a piano, mm-hmm. you know. I mean, I know we're playing piano, and the same with the guitar. Well, it's guitar, but can you make it sound different? So that's when really this all sort of started, you know.
Well, you recall in the book that John Lennon, with the song Tomorrow Never Knows,
right.
wanted to sound like, quote, the Dalai Lama chanting from a mountaintop.
That's right, yeah.
So he didn't say, I want you to attenuate the microphone and
boost
the mid. I mean, that was up to you to figure out how to make him sound like the Dalai Lama chanting on a mountain.
Oh, sure. I mean, these guys were, you know, like, totally non-technical. And why should they be technical? I mean, the gauntlet was sort of thrown down to me, and I'm sort of stuck there in a tremendous nervous state, because that was the very first track we started to record for the Revolver album. And so I'm just, I've got a mixing console, a tape machine, and an echo chamber. So, you know, I'm sort of going crazy. So I was sort of in the studio, and then, because in front of me was this revolving Leslie speaker, as it was called, that was plugged into the Hammond organ, which gave the Hammond organ a distinctive sort of sound.
A wobbly sound, yeah.
Yeah, it was a Doppler effect as the speaker sort of revolved round and round. So I thought, well, if we could break into the circuitry of that and put John's voice into that speaker, then maybe we'd be going up the right path. And of course, that's what we did, and John was just ecstatic when he heard that.
Well, let's hear how it turned out. The song Tomorrow Never Knows. My guest is Jeff Emerick, who engineered this and many other recordings for the Beatles. Boy, talk about a baptism by fire. Jeff Emerick, you were 19 years old at the time, and this was your first song with the Beatles as the engineer. Tomorrow Never Knows. Jeff Emerick's book is Here, There, and Everywhere, My Life Recording the Music of the Beatles. You mentioned that up until this point, your job would have been to take the sounds that the band recorded and the producer had determined were usable and to just create a nice mix.
That's right, yeah.
All of that changes with Revolver. Did you and did the Beatles have a real conscious sense of breaking molds and sort of making recording history during these sessions?
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, we were all into that as a team, and that's really what we wanted to do. And, of course, my problem also, of course, was breaking the rules and regulations within the EMI, because I was sort of misusing the equipment, for want of a better phrase.
Well, you already talked about rewiring the cabinet speaker to get in there and get John's voice into it.
Yeah, but this was like physical abuse of the control room. Yeah?
So basically, I assume a lot of this probably took a lot longer than a regular mix. You guys must have been in there for hours and even days on end.
Yeah, we were because, you know, most of the songs were sort of structured within the confines of the studio rather than demoed up outside of the studio. So we sort of started from scratch. So I also had the luxury of time as they were routining and deciding which instruments to use, you know, to try and, you know, to figure out, you know, what I was going to try on certain things, you know.
Was the studio a particularly difficult place to be innovative? I mean, you've alluded to rules, but just the fact that, you know, they're tiny little windowless rooms. I mean, it seems like the kind of place it would be very difficult to get that creative spark
going.
No,
they weren't like windowless. I mean, the problem was, you know, very regimented. It was like, it looked physically like a hospital inside. And yes, I understand what you're saying. Yes, there was no incentive no creative incentive. Yeah, sure.
But there certainly, I mean, there were some precedents. I mean, the Beatles had some familiarity, I guess, with avant-garde classical music that involved tape and stuff. And
yeah, right.
Were they listening to the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds at this point as well?
I'm not sure whether Pet Sounds was out. I think Pet Sounds was out at this time. I was not quite sure. But I know Paul used to, especially when we're on Tomorrow Never Knows, because of those loops that are on there, and which he used to make at home. In a certain fashion on his Brendel tape recorder. So, I mean, I guess we had like Stockhausen and stuff. I guess Paul was sort of listening to stuff like that, and I guess the others too. I mean, because they were looking for new roads to go down. You know,
right.
I mean?
Yeah. Now, what about you? I mean, as a kid, it seems like you had already determined that you wanted to be an engineer. You know, even though at that time. You know, it wasn't a particularly glamorous job. How did you find this road to pursue?
Well, it was the love of the music. I mean, it wasn't necessarily for want of just being an engineer. I mean, I it was just the love of music from a very, very young age, from the age of like 6 or 7. And I was, you know, listening to my grandmother's records on a toy gramophone. And some of these records were classical. And it was just a question of textures within the music and melodies and things. Well, and I would think, well, if I'd been involved with possibly this, you know, I sort of would have had that louder or this louder and so forth. So it was just applying, and it was an emotion, I guess, from the music. And I just wanted to be involved with recording music, to be honest with you.
Mm-hmm. So 1967, you find yourself involved in the making of Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
That's right, sure, yeah.
You write that the spirit of this endeavor was, quote, if you've got an idea, let's try it.
Yeah, sure.
Was that the idea going in, or was this really something that combusted in the studio?
No, this was an idea going in, because what happened after Revolver, they tried to actually do... To perform some of those tracks live from the Revolver album, and sort of failed, I believe. And the approach when we recorded Sgt. Pepper, in fact, I mean, George's face dropped when basically they told him, that's George Martin, that they didn't want to tour anymore or do any live shows. They just wanted to just concentrate on recording in the studio, so knowing that they wouldn't have to perform the things live, because we were creating these things technically in the studio, and they knew that they couldn't get the same sounds, because this is before, you know, computers and,
sure.
and being able to and so forth. That was the approach.
So Jeff, I mean, do you shoulder a bit of the responsibility for the Beatles giving up live performance? Maybe if you hadn't done your job so well, they would have found a way to go out and perform this stuff.
Oh, well, it's possible. No, you're right. I mean, it's possible. Who knows?
Jeff Emmerich is my guest. His book is Here, There, and Everywhere, My Life Recording the Music of the Beatles. So, Sgt. Pepper, the album starts, ironically enough, with the sense of a live performance. You've got the live crowd noise and stuff.
Right.
All of that being woven in through your mixing desk, right?
That's right, sure.
Here's a little bit from the Beatles. Jeff Emmerich engineered this music by the Beatles. Jeff, these days that would have been a push of a button on a computer to get all those different crowd noises. Back in the day, in 1967, what did you have, like multiple tape decks with tape loops?
Yeah, that's right, and wax pencils and... Yeah.
And razor blades and splicing tape.
We actually had scissors, believe it
scissors.
Or not. EMI weren't into razor blades. We were into brass scissors.
Well, as we've already determined, you did a fair amount of rule breaking and equipment breaking during your day, so maybe they didn't want to arm you with razor blades. A Day in the Life. You know,
right.
This monumental song that would close the album, you write that it actually came pretty early in the making of Sgt. Pepper.
Yes. Well, it did. I remember John demoing that song up in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
Because he came in with his acoustic guitar and he's running it through for Jules Martin. And I know the same thing happened with Strawberry Fields, and, you know, this was like another notch up. You know, I'm thinking, my God, you know, how can these songs get any better? But, you know, it was just magical. And John was very insecure about his vocals, and he was more comfortable when we had what we call tape echo, which some people now call slap echo on his vocal. And so I lifted up the fader with that echo on his voice, and it just sent shivers down our back. You know, it was like, my God, this is just unbelievable. You know, how better can this get? You know.
And here's how it turned out: A Day in the Life from the Beatles.
He blew his mind out in a car. He didn't notice that the lights had changed. A crowd of people stood and stared. They'd seen his face before. Nobody was really sure if he was on the house floor.
John Lennon's voice with a bit of what they call slapback echo, various names for it. Jeff Emerick at the controls. His new book is called Here, There, and Everywhere, My Life Recording the Music of the Beatles. The album Sgt. Pepper came out, Jeff, and you did not get an engineering credit.
No.
Were engineers considered that low a form of musical life that they
I'm afraid so, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
But as you say, this was at a time where the role of both the producer and the engineer, because of this work that the Beatles were doing, was really becoming quite prominent and quite important. So
yes, yeah.
All right, much more to talk about, and we'll take a quick break and then more of our conversation with Jeff Emerick. You can email us, soundcheck@wnyc.org. We're glad to hear from you. Stay with us for more. This is Soundcheck at 93.9 WNYC and online at WNYC.org. I'm John Schaefer, speaking with Jeff Emerick, who was the recording engineer on some of the Beatles' finest records. His new book is called Here, There, and Everywhere, My Life Recording the Music of the Beatles, and he's joined us by phone. Jeff, it's interesting to hear you talking about music that's now, God, 40 years old, and you know, you still sound like you kind of marvel at it, even though you know all the little tricks and the little, you know, the edits and the pieced together parts that make it what it is. As you look back, were there any notable failures, any things that seemed like great ideas at the time, and when you did them, that just didn't work?
I can't really think of anything off the top of my head, not unless you can prompt me if there's something in the book I've said.
Well, no, actually, the reason I asked the question is that it seems like the instincts of the band were pretty unerring.
Well, I just a little bit funny, really. There was one, as I said, because of John's sort of John's not understanding the whole recording process, for want of a better phrase. I mean, John said to me once, he said, well, you know, why do you have to, you know, put the microphone in front of my face to record my voice? You know, why can't you try putting the mic at the back of my head? So, of course, you know, there's no such word as no in their vocabulary. So, in fact, in mine. So I tried it, and of course he realized that it was unusable. So, you know, that's one experiment that didn't work, I guess.
Well, you describe John at one point as creative but inarticulate.
Yes.
So that, you know, in terms of what you needed as an engineer, he could give you sort of the concept he wanted, but it was really up to you, I guess, to kind of figure out what he really meant and how you could really do that.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's trying to read his mind, and he was giving me the fuel, you know, and I was trying to just work around it and try and come up with what he was imagining.
Mm-hmm. You describe Paul as basically emerging as the group's de facto producer, with all due respect to George Martin.
Yeah.
George, your opinion of George seems to change, to progress as the years go on. Is that a fair assessment?
Of George Harrison?
Yeah.
Oh, yes, sure. I mean, you know, when I first, you know, saw George, you know, for want of a better word, struggling to grasp, you know, the guitar solos and things, and we didn't have the luxury of time to begin with. George Martin had a budget to make an album, and you couldn't sit there for days working on stuff. So, yes, it was a good good story of George, you know, struggling through this situation and becoming the prolific sort of guitarist and songwriter that he eventually became. And he, early on, he sort of found his niche in Eastern music.
Mm-hmm. Now, Jeff, you were 15 years old when you first met the Beatles. You were 19 when you became the lead engineer on Revolver. What was your relationship with the band? I mean, were you guys, like, hanging out together, or Were they even around when it came time to do the mixes?
No. I mean, in the early days, they weren't around when we did the mixes, and we didn't hang around together. It was a working relationship. So, I didn't really know them. I knew them in the confines of the studio, which, of course, eventually we spent many months together. But outside of that, with the occasional sort of meetings with Paul, I guess, socially... No, I didn't know them outside of the studio.
But over the course of those months and years in the studio, you certainly got to see a side of the band that would later come to be much discussed after the breakup.
Yeah.
How soon did the kind of the tension, not the good creative tension, but the destructive tensions begin to manifest in the studio?
Oh, that was basically after they came back from India, because they were recording they did the video for Hey Bulldog. We recorded Hey Bulldog that day, and the next day they were going to India. And Hey Bulldog was just a great track to record. They were having great fun down in the studio, and they went to India. And when they came back, they were just angry people. And then that's basically when the sort of rot set in. And
all that transcendental meditation, huh?
Oh yeah, right. But I know later to find out basically through the press, you know, what sort of transpired in India. Mm-hmm. But they came back as angry people, and we started work on the White Album, and we got into about eight tracks of it, and I couldn't stand it anymore, so I had to leave. I said I'm not doing this anymore. It was just awful.
All right, well, before we get to the White Album, I mean, Strawberry Fields Forever, you spend a fair amount of time talking about this piece. You write, it would receive more time and attention than any John Lennon song ever recorded with the Beatles.
Yeah, right.
There's actually a lot of different ways we can pull this apart, but our own engineer, Irene Trudell, has put together a montage for us of some of the parts that you used in putting together the final mix that we all know. Here's some of the Beatles' music from Strawberry Fields Forever.
Let me take you down, 'cause I'm going to Strawberry Fields. Nothing is real, and nothing to get hung about. Strawberry Fields Forever.
All right, so these are some of the parts from which the whole was made, the song Strawberry Fields Forever. Jeff Emmerich, I mean, you had to piece together this song out of these various things that we've just heard. How much did they give you? How much sorting through? Who worked on this?
Well,
with
I mean,
you?
I mean, it wasn't really all stuck together from those bits. I mean, because it was laid down on the multi-track, but I believe we obviously had those parts on I mean, they knew where those bits were going to go. It was us making up the track. But the most complicated thing for me was the fact that we recorded the track, and then John came back and said it wasn't heavy enough. He wanted the track to sound heavier. So we then made a second version of it, where we had, you know, George Martin's orchestration, and we had, you know, those drums and timps banging away, and backwards drums and so forth. And then we'd done the heavier version, and then I believe it was a week later or something, John had had two acetates cut, because we didn't have cassettes in those days. They were demonstration 7-inch records.
Mm-hmm.
And he preferred the first section of the first lighter approach to the song. And then he said, well, can you just stick them together? You know, the first part of the first version into the second, the heavier second version. The problem being they were both different in pitch and tempo. So to cut a long story short, I had to speed up the first take gradually. My edit point was going to be about 60 seconds in on the beginning of the second chorus. Let me take you down because I'm going, and it was on the word going. That's where I was going to do the cut. So I sped up the first section gradually, and then I slowed down the second section to match tempo and pitch and left that slowed down.
And this is how it turned out.
Yeah.
Strawberry Fields from the Beatles. And engineered and edited by my guest, Jeff Emmerich.
Nothing is real. Nothing to get hung about. Strawberry feels forever. Strawberry feels forever. Strawberry feels forever.
Strawberry Fields Forever. My guest Jeff Emmerich engineered this and many other songs for the Beatles. His book is called Here, There, and Everywhere, My Life Recording the Music of the Beatles. Jeff, there are some pretty detailed recollections in this book. And
right.
I mean, of course, there are other people who were around who say, well, this is wrong and that's wrong. Did you keep a diary? Did you keep tape running all the time? How did this happen?
Well, it's just, I mean, you've got to imagine that being involved with those sessions, it's so indelible in your mind, and it's never, ever going to go out of my mind. And that's really what happened. I mean, it's just there, and it's as though all this happened like 2 months ago. In fact, when we went back to do Free as a Bird, and we all worked together again after 25 years, whatever it was, after the Abbey Road album, when we came to record those tracks in the studio, it was as though we'd like sort of just seen each other a month ago and just carried on. It's just a very odd feeling.
Well, you started your career with the Beatles. I mean, what do you do for an encore after that? You went on, you worked with Paul McCartney.
Yeah, sure.
Elvis Costello, you engineered several great records by him.
Yeah.
Nellie Mackay, most recently.
Yeah, right, great.
So what did you take from those years with the Beatles that you've kept with you through all these years since?
What did I take? A sense of back to basics, really, from the music and the songs, and I guess realizing that I can create something out of an artist, for want of a better word. I mean, I always longed to work with Elvis and Costello, and when he asked me to do Imperial Bedroom, I was just, you know, over the moon, and I wanted him to project his voice more, and I wanted to lift his voice out more in the mixes, and he was a little scared of that, and, you know, so it's stuff like that. It's more artistic, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and in fact, Elvis Costello has written the foreword to the book.
That's right, yeah.
Here, There, and Everywhere, My Life Recording the Music of the Beatles. It's by Jeff Emmerich with Howard Massey, and Jeff has been my guest on Soundcheck. Jeff, it's a fascinating story, and it's been told many times from many different points of view, but it's good to have your point of view as well. Thanks for being with us on the program today.
Thank you very much. Thank you. It's a pleasure.
You can email us, soundcheck@wnyc.org.
Thanks for listening to Soundcheck from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Each day we dig into what's happening in music, and you can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. All of this is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.